I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Curious Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello, welcome to the Scanlon Podcast, your podcast of the week in film news, Irish and international. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Grace.
Jason.
So this week, obviously, we'll be doing what we normally do, which is talking about the week in film news. We look in the top 10 and what's coming out this week. But let's start with what we normally start with. So, Jay, what did you watch this week?
Oh, all the things, Darren. I didn't watch all the things. I watched some of the things.
Jay may not have watched all the things.
I did not. Disclaimer. I will start with a film called Disorder.
Ooh, I heard about this.
This is Matthew Schoenaerts. Is it Schoenaerts?
Oh, this is the one. Yes, the one that screened as part of the Odeon screen on Scene last year, and people walked out of. This is the. He's a former veteran, I believe.
Yes,
a bodyguard or something.
Somewhat not surprised he walked out of it, in the sense that it's not bad. It's Diane Kruger, is that
it? It was not good.
No, it's like, there's
but it was also a foreign film that was shown as a surprise.
Yeah,
film,
which probably has a reason for it. Yeah, it's like, we have to read.
I don't come to the cinema to read.
I came here for blood.
Diane Kruger's in it, who I think is shockingly underrated. And really, she never gets parts. And when she looks for the parts, she's kind of wasted when she's in it. And she speaks German and French as well. Like, she's from Germany. So
and obviously
English. She's probably pops up in a lot more European films that I'm aware of as well, I suspect. But she's very good in this. Basically, based story of Schoenaerts is this kind of French soldier. It kind of seems to be like a foreign agent type deal, but it's obviously official because it make reference to he's been out there, which is essentially kind of the Afghanistan type kind of scenario. Yeah. But they're kind of soldier for her to some degree, in that he basically is told by a doctor that he can't go back out there. So, and these guys are basically hired then to kind of do security for rich people in kind of vast estates with big walls, that kind of thing. Yeah. So he kind of minds the family of this rich Lebanese businessman, and the Diane Kruger and son. So far, so generic in the sense that we've seen this setup before. It's essentially the bodyguard, but the bodyguard is much better.
I
love the bodyguard. A, I love Costner, and B, we use the greatness.
There's your point for you.
It's like
the bodyguard, but not as good.
There's some great kind of sequences that come out of nowhere, like two or three little kind of action sequences that work very well. Like kind of unexpected, like they're set up quite well and work quite well. But Schoenaerts is good, Kruger's good. She kind of doesn't get a lot to do except stand there and looking worried, but she's much better than that and really deserves more.
And she does it very well.
Yeah, she does. But it's not very good. It's passable kind of afternoon fair, but nothing crazy.
Confident, basically.
Just a bit. Next one.
You say it, we're so
just a bit confident is okay, like in the sense that, you know, we're always disappointed. The next one I watched then was a film called News from Home, which is a Chantal Ackerman documentary from 1977, which is really interesting in that it's kind of real bare-bones cinema in the sense that she moved to America in the mid-70s, or kind of just after mid-70s, just about a year or two before this was made. And she basically set up kind of static cameras in New York, or there's cameras on, like, vehicles that the cameras stay still, and vehicle moves, and basically records the city. So it has that time capsule effect in the mid-70s New York. But on it then, she reads out letters from her mother, from home, kind of, you know, telling her family history.
Giving like a well-known sort of experience.
Uncle John is in hospital today, and and whatever is asked for you. And hope you learned the English language so you can do well in New York. Have you made any films? That kind of stuff. So the kind of worried mother kind of letters there. But the mother's really funny in the sense of kind of, there's always like mysterious ailments that have, she's always kind of not feeling well, and you know, we have to go to the country because we're tired. You know, this is like kind of sort of French aristocracy vibe off the letters, so they're quite funny. But they're kind of add to that alienation which the city kind of escapes that she shows. Kind of like the kind of long kind of streets of kind of some empty and stuff like that. So that's that kind of being alone in a strange land whilst the letters are read out over it. Mm-hmm. And that's this really loud, quite loud thing going on that cities do as well, whereby like, you know, it's all quiet in the street and it holds for like a few minutes, so you kind of get lulled into it. Then it kind of, it's on a smash cut to it, subway train really loud, like kind of thing to kind of jolt you. It's really good, like, and it's like, you think it'd be dull in the sense that nothing happens, like, it's like this is as simple as it gets film wise, but it's really, really captivating.
And it sounds like now that sort of Aquinas Nazi vibe almost, like the rhythm of living.
Yeah, it is, and like, New York looks so weird and so 70s. you know that kind of way? It's like in the way that like New York doesn't look. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's
back when it looked like a dive.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it has the exact thing.
When the city went bankrupt.
Glamorous and lovely, like it doesn't.
Summer Sam.
Fortune to recreate for films and stuff like that.
The Deuce, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So also on CGI, it's kind of nailed for the city, but. Yeah, that's about really well worth watching. Ackerman's really great eye for visuals, and the letters are quite poignant at points and quite funny at others. Like, so it's kind of never less than interesting. And then I'll go one more, because I have to, which is...
Do you have to?
Mamma Mia.
Here we go again.
All right. Ronan Doyle, Ronan Doyle said I should watch Mamma Mia, right, because he said it's great. Right. I avoided Mamma Mia like the plague for a long time because it's Mamma Mia. So I watched Mamma Mia on Sunday morning, and it's great fun. I was shocked at how much I enjoyed it. Like, the first 15 minutes is really odd because you've both seen it, right?
Yeah.
I haven't.
Okay. I won't go on too much, but it's Amanda Seyfried, this is the younger girl.
She's getting married.
Right, so. Okay.
They can't all be winners.
They did. But her friends arrived on the island in Greece, like, and the three of them are all excited and talking and everything. They're kind of young-ish, I think. They're 18, 20-ish kind of thing. I can't really tell, but they're quite young.
I like how this is Jay being in touch with the common people.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the range of between 8 and 25.
Yeah, yeah. But they're all chatting, they're all excited. And honestly, it looks like, you know, the way you get those kind of Dove commercials where they're clearly kind of dubbed in from a different language. And yeah, like, you know, they're trying to fit the words in. It looks like that. And I'm like, oh my God, this is awful. It's the whole film carrying on like this. But then it cuts into kind of the kind of old prose of Brosnan, Firth, and Skarsgård.
And also, obviously,
and Julie Walters. Yeah. Like.
And a minor character actress you probably haven't heard of.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the six of them come into the film, and they go through it. Like, it's amazing. It kicks up a level. Baranski
walks
away with the film. Brosnan murders every song he plays. It's almost hypnotic.
And he's so into it.
Oh, he is. It's bad karaoke in the best sense.
My favourite part of Mamma Mia was the press tour beforehand, before anybody had seen a frame of it, where Brosnan was like, I was actually really intimidated to do this because I've never sung before.
What?
But when I performed on stage, people were saying I could release a solo album. And like, nobody had seen a frame of the film, so they're like, oh my God, because
this would be amazing. He's
rolling them all in advance, pretty much.
Yeah.
But the film is tremendous fun. Like, it's great. Like, it's bonkers. And then I found out, like, after it, which I completely aware of, the sequel coming out in July.
It's going to be a flashback to when the three characters were younger. Do you want me to dig out the fact machine?
I'll do it. Your call is very important, please hold it on.
Thank you. It's seamless.
But Mamma Mia is fantastic. Weirdly, like, for a film that made an absolute fortune, it made like 600 million or something, right? I think it's Philippa Lloyd directed it. But she wasn't invited back for the sequel, which tends to happen.
Yeah, the director's directed by Alan Parker.
Yeah, that's right. I was curious, this does tend to happen with films that make money that direct women. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Lily James is playing the young Donna. Jessica Keenan Wynn is playing young Tanya, that's the Baranski character. And Alexa Davies is playing the young Julie Walters. Jeremy Irvine is playing the young Pierce Brosnan, which is not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Skinner, who I never heard of, is playing the young Harry. And Josh Dillon, who I never heard of, is playing the young Stellan Skarsgård.
I'm worried. I'm really worried. That's a real...
The original cast are back, apparently.
Already?
So it may just be a flashback.
Right.
Maybe
they'll
have
like an opening scene where they all sit there and a little speech bubble comes out, or a thought bubble.
And then there's Lily James.
And then you just go into the thought bubble.
That could easily happen if you've seen Mamma Mia. I could see that.
Seems
like Jeff Goldblum in the new Jurassic Park sort of thing. It's like, we got them for a day. What can we do in a day?
But Mamma Mia is terrific and should be watched.
Who shares in it?
And shares in it, yeah. Shares apparently playing Meryl Streep's mother. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work. But that's right.
That
here.
Is quite hilarious.
Hey,
that's a reach.
Look, both Oscar-winning actors. It's, you know, I mean,
I'll be first in front center for that one. Put that in 4DX, I say.
Mamma Mia is great because Mamma Mia was counter-programming in 2008 to The Dark Knight. It's the thing you don't get anymore, because we were talking about a little while earlier where you had like Infinity War, where Infinity War just stood alone, and there was like nobody would counter-program against it, and it kind of lose something because you don't really get those anymore.
Controversial point there. Mamma Mia better than The Dark Knight? Discuss.
Jay, I like you. I like you a lot. You're funny, you're hilarious,
you
are great things. I like Mamma Mia.
Yeah, but...
I like Mamma Mia.
All
Let's
right,
leave it
mean,
there.
All
That's
all
the
right,
positive
all right.
note.
I've run this comes to the edge of another one. Fair enough.
So, Grace, what did you watch?
Grace. Right. Well, last night I watched The Intern, the Nancy Meyers film, which is one of the few movies of hers that I actually hadn't seen. She's a filmmaker I do actually quite like in many ways. She's obviously very prolific as a female filmmaker and has like been very successful at that. I think when What Women Want came out and was very commercially successful.
Yeah.
But at the time, it made her, I think, the most successful female director because it had made more money. Directed by a woman. But, so I was looking forward to this, but then something I always find curious about her movies is that, like, they all have a certain sort of look to them. It's like if you took, like a white linen scented candle and turned it into a film. That's what they all look like. And in one sense, like, there's a lot of attention to detail and a lot of aesthetics to it, which when, if you've ever seen her interviewed about her writing process, it actually is very clear why she does all of this. In terms of setting up the world and imagining the characters and giving them all a specific voice. But it's funny because then you sort of end up in a world where every single one of her characters are just impossibly and sometimes even improbably rich, like just ridiculously well off. And all of their problems are ludicrous. Like in It's Complicated with Meryl Streep, for instance, she has this enormous house that she lives in alone because she's divorced and all her children are grown up. And she's getting an extension built onto it for some unknown reason.
Was it her daughter did Home Again with Reese Witherspoon, which has a similar plot, where it's about Reese Witherspoon who has an extension already built on her house, where three students come and live and help parent her kid, and that's a story.
There's a lot of extensions.
There's
an extension in Father of the Bride Part 2 as well.
Yeah. It might, I suspect they'd irk you. Although I really loved It's Complicated, and I actually do quite like The Intern. I think The Intern does what it says out to do very well, but I liked It's Complicated only because, I mean, Meryl Streep is the only actress who could properly convey the challenge of choosing between Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin. I mean,
my favorite review of that was that, like, and I think, this had to have been written by a woman, possibly even in the Sindo, but a film reviewer said something like, of course, the problem here is that you have, like, Alec Baldwin versus Steve Martin, and it's like, with Alec Baldwin, in her words, you would, even though you hate yourself. With Steve Martin, never, in a million years. So this is like the false equivalent, clearly, which completely ruins the story.
That says a lot about, though, Nancy Meyers' aesthetic, is that in that aesthetic, Steve Martin is like a threatening bad boy. And I mean, like, I like the Nancy Meyers one. I think they're great. I actually really do. I think there's something.
She's made, like, Something's Gotta Give and The Holiday.
I've seen The Holiday, like.
Yeah, The Holiday's not great.
I have a soft spot for The Holiday. Yeah, even though it's definitely not, it's not the best.
Okay.
But it's enjoyable in a very stupid way. But,
Parents Trap, Father of the Bride.
Parents Trap, Lindsay Lohan.
Loved that growing up.
I've seen that. That's pretty good. Yeah.
And the two Father of the Bride remakes, which, although it might be sacrilegious to say, I do kind of prefer them to the old ones.
I like Steve Martin's old guy.
My favourite thing, though, about the first Father of the Bride, the remake, is that the character in it, Annie, who's getting married, has a wedding that literally costs $144,000. Because there's a point in it where, like, they say, oh, the wedding will cost, like, $250 a head. And then at an earlier date, they had said that they were inviting like 560 people or something. So I actually put that into a calculator and was like, the wedding cost the price of a house. Which is hilarious, to get back to my original point, because Annie as a character is like, gets really angsty over gender roles and is like, I didn't think I wanted to be married because, like, you know, marriage means you lose your independence and all this. And she has a big argument with her fiancé because he buys her a blender and she's like, why are you buying me kitchen stuff and all this sort of thing. But she still expects her parents to pay $144,000.
Traditional versus modern
feminist aesthetic that seems to filter through all of Nancy Meyers' movies. Which, to bring it back to The Intern, happens again, where you have Anne Hathaway's character who is incredibly successful and runs her own company, which is just basically just blown up like a startup in 18 months or so. And then finds out that, this is kind of a spoiler, but I'm sure nobody cares, finds out that her husband is having an affair and doesn't want to leave him because she doesn't want to die alone. Which, you know, would seem like quite a normal human concern for somebody in that situation. But then it all just kind of goes a bit haywire because she ends up staying with the husband. And the husband sort of tells her to stay with him and not to hire a CEO. And it's like, it's all a bit messy. But the Intern is a lovely film. It's very enjoyable. And the character work between Robert De Niro, and it's so nice to see him playing somebody normal in a non-crap movie. It's just such a departure
from a lot
of the crap that he's
not
been
your
making.
Dirty grandpa.
But there's a lovely, like, warm, heartfelt friendship between the two of them. But some of the kind of background issues that seem to filter through in a lot of her movies do take away from it somewhat, but maybe not so, not enough to make it not enjoyable, but just to kind of be like, is that really necessary?
I mean, I like the fact that, and again, this is the thing that when you go to a Myers movie, you know what you're going to get, but the fact that her movies are entirely non-threatening, and like, you watch a Myers movie, and like, romantic comedies, and you know, I know obviously The Intern isn't technically a romantic comedy, but they're all built around this idea of like the third act twist where you have the characters who have this revelation, everything's apocalyptic, everything's called off, it's going to be the worst thing ever.
Okay.
But Myers doesn't tend to do that. Her like apocalyptic crises consist of, as you pointed out, you know, I'm going to die alone at some distant point in the future, but it's okay because I'll work through that because I'm competent, I'm confident, I'm reassured, I have financial security, you know, I have social security.
Always enormous sizes.
Yeah, but I also have, like, you know, I'm secure and confident in myself and I can manage this. And it's, you know, I like that about it. They never make my top 10 end of year list or anything like that. But they're not melodramatic. They're just grand. They're reassuring.
Successful
as well,
aren't they?
Yeah, and I think
like,
there's a niche, you
make money and she continues
to work.
There's
this very sort of old-fashioned kind of romantic idol in them, and that quite a lot of the time she'll have female characters who are quite, you know, brittle and they have insecurities and maybe they've been through something quite traumatic, but it's always explored like in the context of a blossoming relationship with a man, and half the time you see it through the man's eyes, which is a little bit irritating because I'm like, this is very rich material that you could totally explore without the romance angle. But like you say, this is what she does.
And it sells as well.
And I mean, and she seems comfortable and happy doing it, which is good as well. Because I mean, there is something to be said for, and again, this is the Ron Howard thing where it's like, it's something to be said for being able to do what you do really well, even if what you do isn't produced like works that are, in inverted commas, artistically magnificent.
You didn't have to bring on Ron Howard, didn't you? Have to.
Okay, what?
We will not stand for people dissing Ron Howard. He's like your lovable uncle that you could turn to in a crisis.
Nancy Meyers like your lovable aunt who's telling you that it's not as bad as it looks.
Who's probably divorced
from
Ron.
But it is as bad as it looks.
But she's building that extension. You're happy to live there when it's finished.
Yeah, and it's going to look absolutely pristine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Impeccable interior design.
You guys.
Right, and then at the weekend, I rewatched Ingrid Goes West for the first time since I saw it in the cinema. Still love it. Still think it's fantastic. Send up of influencer culture, so to speak. But what I think I appreciated more on this watch was just how much the film in its structure and its characterization, what minimal characterization there is, because they're all archetypes, basically. It reflects the world that it's parodying. You know, it's very glossy, very superficial, very ephemeral. You get these kind of snapshots of insights into people's minds, and they're all phrased through, like, hashtags and Instagram captions and all this sort of stuff. But I think it's done in a very knowing way. Like, you can tell this isn't an adult kind of trying to poke fun at the youth for being, like, really empty-headed and everything. There's a sense that people know what appeals about this world to people, but also they can recognize how inherently silly and just a bit stupid it is. And the performances in it are still gold. Albert Plaza's is awesome.
She's great.
I love that it has that really sort of deliciously dark ending where it sort of implies that she's learned absolutely nothing and it's just basically chapter two of the same thing.
I cut up to that late. Like, I didn't catch it last year. I think start this year. Was it last year?
It was last year,
I kind of bypassed me completely, so I only caught up with it like a few months ago. I really liked it. Also, it did a really good performance from O'Shea Jackson Jr., who I liked a lot since...
Since, obviously, getting a Straight Out of Compton.
Straight Out of Compton, yeah.
He's also very good in Den of Thieves. I know you're a big Harry Potter fan.
I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. But he's really good in that, and him and Plaza play off each other very well in it. I liked it. I'm sure at some point, but I thought it was very good.
I think there might be a bit of a limit on its terms, though, because we were watching it with my mom, and she was really just like
younguns.
Yeah, this is what passes for filmmaking.
I've said that though. I have said that about films. So very soon. Good God, can we not come back to the '40s? Like, listen to yourself, Jay. Jesus.
Old man Coyle.
I'm not wrong.
Shakespeare's that cloud.
Yeah,
computing.
I've done it. I'm
where everything
could
be on film in 70 millimeters.
I mean,
it's
funny.
You
know,
that's
exactly.
A 70 millimeter crease. Do not watch Dunkirk on an iPhone.
No, it actually held
us quite well.
I'm not going to be seen on every format then.
Okay, fine. Anyway.
An iPhone on the Lewis.
With the headphones on. Anyway, so is there anything else?
No, that's me. Otherwise, I've just been watching boring old television.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wonders Never Cease. Indeed. Television's great. I suspect we may talk a little bit about television when we get to the news section, if only because it seems to be the thing that everybody's talking about. But anyway, so what I watched this week, I watched a whole bunch of stuff, so very quickly just rattling them off. Black Panther is still very good. Watching it for like the third or fourth time, what's amazing is the pacing. It's actually paced remarkably well. Road to Perdition, a rewatch again.
Ooh, I haven't seen that in years.
I like it. I still like it. Again, the thing is with Mendes is going back to American Beauty is now impossible. So it's like,
He made that.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, this is it, I guess, then?
Revolutionary Road.
Revolutionary Road is grand. I like Revolutionary Road a lot.
More than you do.
Okay, I like it a lot, but it's not Road to Perdition good. Like, Road to Perdition is...
Oh, wait, I would say it's a better film.
Okay.
But I like Road to Perdition's heavily stylized, but really, really well put together.
It's fantastically made, and like, again, this is
great
weird because that's a great performance. It's Tom Hanks's, like, this is... I was speculating a little while ago what it would look like if Tom Hanks made a Training Day. And this is probably as close as you're going to get, and he's still cuddly.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, it's still cuddly. It's like,
actually, yeah.
If you were to do like a Tom Hanks as an anti-hero movie, this would probably come close. Jude Law is very good in it. It's
Paul Newman.
Yeah, Paul Newman's amazing.
Paul
Newman.
Is it possible
for Paul Newman to not have ever been amazing?
Is the answer. It's not.
He phoned it in and it still would have been better.
He's just an easygoing great, like.
Yeah.
I see that final scene
with him as well, where he's discussing his son and how he can't give him up and stuff.
Late Newman is great, like, he has this kind of
old man, if you will.
Yeah, but he's just like kind of ease and charm. And I know how to play this, I've been doing this for 60 years, guys. Like, kind of vibe off, and he just plays so well, it's great.
He really does. I actually prefer him to Redford.
Cool.
I also rewatched Ghost Town, which is David Koepp's one of David Koepp's directorial films. This is the one with Ricky Gervais.
It's probably
the most watchable Ricky Gervais ever been. It's not a fantastic film.
That's a high bar.
That's the highest possible bar. Greg Kinnear plays a man who basically died and is trying to reconcile with his wife, played by Taya Leone, and Ricky Gervais, the dentist, who serves as like the spiritual medium between them.
I want to know when we're going to get past the stage where like the English comic flavor of the month just pops up in every random movie. Like, it was, what's his face, Russell Brand for a while, Ricky Gervais, James Corden at the moment.
Coogan does a bit more than that, though, generally. He can act and hold his own in film.
He has a few credentials.
I like Coogan. I think he's a better actor than people give him credit for. Mm-hmm. But I think the general point is absolutely fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't stand Brand either, so Brand and Gervais will basically turn me off anything.
Alright. Yeah, they won't put you on this anyway. There's an extended recurring joke about how Americans don't understand Gervais' dry British wit, which is at once...
Simpsons kind of lowered themselves out there.
He wrote that one and guest starred.
Of course he did.
Yeah. New watch for me, Girls Trip, which I was really looking forward to and was...
Still haven't seen.
Really disappointed.
Trip is fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, it's ferociously bizarre. Like, it doesn't.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah.
It's like it's got no management of tone, right?
And I mean, that's not a problem because some of the tones are great. Some of the tones are less great.
It's messy. It's all over the place, right?
But it being all over the place is not the issue. It's more the fact that the individual notes don't work. So you have extended periods where it's just not funny.
Yeah, I know, because it's a little long as well, if I remember correctly.
It's 2 hours, but it feels that
it should be an hour and a half, though. Yeah. And it's a better film as an hour and a half, you imagine.
Yeah.
Like, Haddish is amazing, though. Haddish is so good.
The entire ensemble is really great. In particular, Regina Hall is great as well. She never got the due that she was supposed to get. Jada Plinkett-Smith is really good as well.
Yeah, she's
like, the entire ensemble is fantastic. And there's a lot of charm there, there's a lot of wit there, but I guess because I've heard so much about it, I was expecting something on par with, say, Bridesmaids in terms of quality.
No, it's not like
that. And it's more in terms of, it's like one of the good Adam Sandler films.
It's a good in some scenes for the ages, though.
Yeah. Oh, no, there's some fantastic scenes.
There's one.
And there are, go really. They cross the line and back again.
Stunning kind of.
Oh, you mean when they go across and back? Yeah. That's fantastic.
It's like, oh my God.
The grapefruit sequence.
Yeah,
I watched this as a Mooney Family movie with my parents. Oh, really? It was a very interesting experience. It was a bit disappointed with it, if I'm being entirely honest.
I enjoyed it, but I think you're right, there are stretches where nothing really kind of works. It's kind of like, get back to the thing you were doing earlier.
Or even just get on to the next thing. Don't stay on this thing for so long. So continuing Darren's rewatch of underrated alien films, I rewatched Alien Covenant, which is still not a good film, but a deeply fascinating.
You're masochist.
It's amazing.
There is something compelling sometimes, though, about watching a film that you can recognize is a mess, but in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
And I know, like, you're probably all going to laugh at this, but I felt that way about Warcraft. I found Warcraft
a
very
Warcraft.
Endearing disaster, to be honest.
That or Mute, Jay. That or Mute.
I haven't seen either. I probably...
I'm going to go out on a limb and say you probably wouldn't like Warcraft.
Can He's I... not going
to
like Mute.
not to pull away from those, but I have yet to see...
Source Code.
No, what's his name? The director, Duncan Jones. I've yet to see a film of his I've liked.
Jay?
Yeah.
Love pause.
And I know everybody loves Moon.
I haven't seen Moon.
It's okay. It's just about okay. It's the best film, but it's not a high bar.
Jay?
Yes?
Bold corner.
I know everybody thinks Moon's a masterpiece. It is not a masterpiece.
Moon is fantastic. Source Code is good.
Source Code is
Source Code is Hitchcock meets Groundhog Day.
No, it's not. It
See, that tagline isn't selling it to me. Not a massive fan of Hitchcock.
I may get to Warcraft at some point.
Alright, fine. But anyway, so yeah, Alien Covenant is fantastic. It's a movie about the horrors of making a franchise horror movie. It's like, you can tell that Ridley Scott was dragged back kicking and screaming to the point where, like, rewatching it and paying attention to the dialogue, there are several points where characters go, "Why the fuck are we doing this?" And other characters go, "Because you said you would." And you can tell that Ridley Scott is behind the camera going, "Yeah, I guess I committed to make this sequel."
Yeah, they kind of got millions to make, they didn't have to make. He wasn't dragged back out.
Okay.
He paid a pile of money to put together a piece of crap.
It's very...
And he did it.
It's very...
That's all. I've no sympathy for him. Like, it's you sound like there's sympathy to be there for a director that is banging the middle.
A director
right,
who wants to...
Who hasn't made a good film in 25 years.
Okay, Jay?
We've been over this.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But this is going out there, like, with your questionable Ron Howard opinions.
Yeah. But no,
well, calm
it's
down.
It's very clear that he whatever you can say about Scott, Scott generally makes movies that appeal to Scott. And whatever.
I'd agree.
His directorial vision is generally unfettered, and when it's fettered, his unfettered vision tends to win out the infamous director's guts of Kingdom of Heaven and Blade Runner come to mind in that respect. But the thing about Prometheus and Alien Covenant is you can tell that he wants to make a movie that requires a big studio budget to make. He wants to make like a grand... Like, Prometheus is basically Forbidden Planet of the 2010s. And I know that people don't like it. I quite like it for that respect. It's a throwback 50s movie just made on a modern budget. But in order to get that made, he obviously has to make artistic compromises. And when it comes to Covenant, which is the sequel to Prometheus, he has to make even bigger artistic compromises in order to get the budget that he wants.
Like, I mean, surely, if any... Like, whenever I think of Ridley Scott, and I have liked some of his films, like, surely he can get a budget and make whatever the hell he wants. Like, surely The Martian made a fortune, didn't it?
Which one's The Martian, yeah.
So, like, I mean, how can he not get a budget?
I suspect...
You know, to make whatever science fiction-y idea he has.
You get...
You know.
There's a very... You watched at least an hour of this, Jay. You're telling me you don't... You think...
I've watched all of it.
You watched all of it?
I've watched all of Covenant and the Prometheus, God help me.
Okay. And you don't feel the mangling, the compromise in there? Okay, but
I hear what you're saying. I have to rewatch it with that in mind.
He's a director that would allow himself to be reined in.
Yeah. But
it's hard to imagine him doing battle with a studio and him not just going like that.
Part of me, though, he's a relatively professional. I suppose as famous as he's known for being grumpy in interviews and being grumpy in interactions. He is a professionalist. Again, this is the thing where you point to...
He's always thought of that as, I bring films in on budget.
On budget and on time. Yeah. Like, he's a man who...
That should be a minimum.
It is a minimum requirement.
Yeah.
It is a bare minimum requirement, but it's very rare.
I agree with that.
This is why we appreciate people like Nancy Allen and Ron Howard in this podcast, Jay.
Yes.
But yeah, so you get that sort of thing where you can tell that Scott got the direction to make it more like an Alien movie, and so he basically raises several gigantic middle fingers at several points in it, to the point where the climax is basically him raising both sets of middle fingers to James Cameron.
See,
with an end sequence involving aliens, a claw hammer, an attack on a ship after everybody thinks they're safe. An android, a trip into cryosleep that turns out to be much nastier than expected.
And I'm happy enough for anybody to raise a finger at James Cameron. That's fine with me. I'd have to watch it again with that in mind to find out.
And you're not going to.
I'm not going to do that. So.
Cool. And then finally, I watched Fahrenheit 451.
Oh,
the
yes.
HBO television film starring Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon. And my reaction was lukewarm, if you will.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's not great.
Fahrenheit 200? Hey.
And a push. Hey.
I have no idea what that
is in Celsius. It doesn't
matter. We're going with it. But again, it's a fascinating film. It's a great example of like HBO trying to muscle in. And we had a discussion about like the Netflix movies, obviously.
Yeah. This one feels like.
Stuff like the Sky movies doing Anon a couple of weeks ago, for example.
Mobile phone ad.
Yeah,
that's what it looks like.
It really is.
No offense to him.
No.
No offense to mobile phone ads.
It would be very hard to offend Anon. But the issue of Fahrenheit 451 is you can see HBO trying to muscle in that, because obviously they did Game Changer beforehand. They did, what was the one before that? Recount. As well.
Yeah,
they've made political movies before.
They've got the one called The Tale coming out as well with Laura Dern.
Yes. That's HBO, is it?
Brilliant, yeah.
I've heard it's amazing. Yeah, I didn't know
it's shown in America. It's a Jennifer Fox directed film about kind of sexual abuse with Laura Dern, and it's supposed to be incredible. It's being shown at Sundance
and stuff like that. It's
supposed to be amazing.
I didn't know that was an HBO one. So yeah, that may be a much safer bet than Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I think that's where they're
aiming.
I think that kind of area is where they're good at.
Yeah.
I think just all of a sudden having to go with like sci-fi, I think is perhaps not the greatest idea.
Yeah, it basically. The thing is, though, the production is very good. The costume design is fantastic.
Great.
Set's fantastic. The two lead performances are amazing. Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon, neither of whom are pushing each other. Michael B. Jordan is the young, innocent recruit who's starting to question the nature of his reality and coming to terms with the horrible system in which he's been complicit. Michael Shannon is the man
who's biting off chunks of scenery left, right, and center.
Who's wrestled with the fact that he's a part of a horrible system and basically decided to lean into it.
He goes full Michael Shannon.
He doesn't actually. It's actually a surprisingly restrained performance, but it works very well. It's stock Michael Shannon. It's like if you were going to a warehouse and they had like the Michael Shannon on sale, this would be the no-frills model. But it works
your
very
basic
well.
Package.
Your basic package. It's like your, you know, it's your Van Alden from Boardwalk Empire, for example. It's your Strickland from, obviously, from Shape of Water. It's, you know, it's your pure package, like Michael Shannon. And that's grand. The issue is the story, because it's very much, it's aimed at, like, Trump's America, obviously, because that's what everything's about now. But it's all about the dumbing down of American popular culture.
It's more in the books.
Well, I mean, the Ray Bradbury book, obviously, is what inspired it. And it's been seen historically as a pan against censorship. But this is where it gets complicated, because Bradbury's always come back and said, no, it's not about censorship. What are you talking about? It's actually about how awful television is and new media and how it's corrupting kids' minds. And so you've always had...
HBO is not going to get into that.
Well, you've always had that tension when it comes to talking about Fahrenheit 451, where you have this liberal progressive reading of it about how terrible, like this Orwellian sort of nightmare about like restriction and thought police, and you have Bradbury, whose old man shakes fist at cloud, going, kids these days with their rock and roll and their hip hop. And the film has an aspect of that, because it's at once it's very much about Trump and it's very much about the internet, and it's like you pointed out, Ingrid Goes West is a very good internet era film. This is not. This has like the Bible written using emojis, which is a clever idea, but it doesn't deserve the attention that
it's
it gets.
It's like the olds, though, again, thinking that they understand the way people communicate.
What about the Bible, but with emojis? Whoa.
Mind blown.
Why would a youth ever be reading the Bible, A, and B, why would they want to read it in an emoji form? Like, unless they're hardcore God types, in which case, again, I'm sure they're going to prefer words.
But the issue is then you have that sort of like stop Trump stuff going on. But then you also have this weird bit in the middle where Beatty explains the roots of this fascist regime. And he's like, oh, this all started with Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, when the black people didn't like the use of the N-word. So they cut that out. And feminists, well, they had an opinion about books about women. So we cut that out as well. You're like, oh no, this is turning into like the Milo Yiannopoulos. How do you pronounce that?
Nobody cares. The blonde guy everything.
Yes, it was like the freedom of speech on campus. The weird American fixation with like denying a platform to somebody or engaging in constructive criticism of speech is, you know, suppression of speech.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have this weird push and pull within the film itself, where it seems to be saying like, Trump's America is bad. But like calling out racially and sexually insensitive material is also evil. So don't do that either.
So this is the old both sides bad of each other defense
sort of thing.
That certain people use on the internet about certain things.
Yeah, and it's got that. On top of that, it's got a really awful plot, because it basically strips out like Bradbury's criticism of television feels entirely justified when you watch Fahrenheit 451. It's like I see what Bradbury
was
getting
at. What he was getting at.
Yeah, right here. Because
so in that sense, it's very faithful episode.
It's the most faithful
episode. You want it.
Yeah. And it,
fantastic.
Because it basically strips out a lot of... Because Bradbury's book is obviously, it's messy, it goes various directions, has lots of threads, characters, elements like that. It doesn't necessarily have a clear linear plot that progresses ABC. Whereas the movie... The movie does that thing that science fiction movies do, where the dystopian regime discovers the Omnis, which, you know, sounds like ominous, which is a device that writes every book in human history onto a strand of DNA. And my God, if the rebels get hold of this, this will represent the end of our despotic regime. So Michael Shannon, Michael B. Jordan, you guys get on this. And it's really patronizing and condescending and trite, and it just doesn't work, and it's most of the movie.
This sounds like an annoying editing.
It's not a good movie, which is a shame, because it's got a lot of the ingredients of a really, really good movie.
Oh. Back to the drawing board, lads.
Yeah. But with emojis this time.
Although, funny, I've seen somebody describe the novel on Twitter the other day as they couldn't even make a good trash movie of a novel that's essentially trash. It's like,
yeah.
Alright, there's the internet for you.
Yeah.
You know what's an absolute benchmark in that regard is Starship Troopers. Trashy novel, amazingly trashy movie.
But also with embedded kind of satire as well, like really good, strong
and done so
stuff.
Well that you can tell most people don't even realize they're meant to be taking the piss out of
Well, that's the thing, is that Heinlein's book is very much Starship Troopers without the irony.
Yeah.
So the movie just ladles on the irony on top of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's a famous story that apparently, like, Gene Roddenberry asked Robert Heinlein to write for Star Trek. Heinlein said no, and Roddenberry's like, okay, fuck this. Star Trek is now the anti-Heinlein science fiction. But yeah, there's.
I never just want to watch Starship Troopers again. Would you like to know more?
I would like to know more.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to talking about the news. So the film Galway, which I believe you're heading to.
I am going for the first time ever, so...
It's running, it's their 30th annual. It's running again from the 10th through the 15th of July.
I'll be there for the 12th.
Oh, okay, cool. And they're screening, they've announced four premieres, including three Irish films. So, Ross Whittaker's documentary Katie, about Katie Taylor.
Yeah, Ross Whittaker's a fine filmmaker, I'm looking forward to that.
And I'm really looking forward to it, because it seems quite well-timed as well.
Yeah.
David Gleason's drama Don't Go, and the stop-motion animation Captain Morton and the Spider Queen.
I think it's the first stop-motion animation in Ireland.
That's pretty amazing.
Which I like stop motion animation anyway, so I'll be there for that.
But
it's quite impressive.
Yeah.
A massive sort of soft spot for that, and it's great to see it as well. Don't Go is starring Stephen Dorff, actually, which is quite impressive.
Who? He's back!
He's back!
Did he ever go away?
And
the last thing I've seen him in was the Sophie Coppola film.
Glimmering? No.
Somewhere. Which is not a good film. Uh-huh. I'm afraid to say. I mean, really, really didn't like it.
I think that's the only one of hers I haven't seen.
I thought it was awful.
Well, hopefully Don't Go will be good enough that it will dwarf that film in your memory.
Oh, indeed.
Melissa George is co-starring as well from Grey's Anatomy. And supporting cast includes Irish actors Simon Delaney from The Conjuring. Okay, fine. Gavin O'Connor will be in there as well. Laura Roddy as well from Michael Inside. He seems to be having a bit of a moment, actually.
Yeah, he's great in Michael Inside.
He's really, really good in that.
Yeah.
And Luke Griffin as well.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's happening. Meanwhile, Tom Von Lohler won Best Actor for Maze at the Albania Film Festival.
Is that made up? Where is that? What is that?
What?
You sound like you made that up. Come on, hit me with the information. It's not a real place.
We're having our breath.
It's the Festival International du Film de...
Do you want me to say it? I speak
French.
Yeah,
you speak French.
Where is it?
Yeah, it's just there. International.
Festival International du Film
d'Aubagne.
Beautiful, beautiful. There. Great attempt.
That was perfect. Thank you, Grace.
I think you'll take the French stuff from now on.
Yeah.
Darn, you're out.
I'm out. But yeah, so
Maze. This is on Netflix.
Maze is now available on Netflix.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I want to see it.
Netflix actually have a really good Irish film selection. I was on there. Yeah, I was on there during the week, and they also have, I don't know if they've drummed
a
keeper
yet. Shows as well.
But they have, what?
A couple of telly shows as well.
Yeah,
you can see these
things sort of. Yeah, they have
Cancel
Bone Cult, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What movies?
They also
have Avengers.
They have, like, Handsome Devil as well, was on there, for example.
Yeah.
I think
and Carver Gangsters.
Sixth Street was on there for a while.
It was,
I don't know if it's been taken off now, but it was there.
And I mean, like, again, this is, you're talking about, you know, like, Irish films permeating. Like,
yeah,
that's how you do it.
No, absolutely.
You get on Netflix.
Yeah.
I will be seeing Maze on it, so.
Cool. I hope you find it amazing. See what
you
I
were
did?
Just waiting for that.
I was. That's the only
reason.
The only
that
reason
today. Tom Von Lohr.
That's the only Jeez. Reason that this sort of made it. Tom Von Lohr is very, very good in this. Tom Von Lohr is very, very good in most things.
I agree.
Amazing.
Hey! Good God.
Don't worry. I'm sure you'll be a captive audience, Jay. For international listeners, maze is a prison. That's why I made that combination of words there.
And for international audience, listen to this. I'm shaking my head wearily. And for Irish audiences, I'm also shaking my head weirdly.
Jay is very inclusive in that regard.
I am.
And otherwise, in terms of news, probably worth talking about Roseanne Barr.
Yes.
And the infamous meltdown where she made several racially charged, let's just call them racist, remarks about a former Obama administration aide, which basically led to ABC cancelling her show in the space of, I think, about 6 hours.
Pretty sharpish, yeah, because I think... Was it a producer and maybe some of the... Well, a producer definitely watched it.
Wanda Sykes walked away.
And then I think some of the cast possibly were threatening to do so also.
Yeah. So ABC basically brought the hammer down quite quickly, which was remarkable. Now, this is the thing where you don't want to be... Don't want to give too much credit to ABC, because the obvious question is, how the hell
they
did the show get this far?
Yeah,
in the first place.
It get revamped, I mean, in the sense that... Well, I know why. There's a couple of reasons. One, this show was very successful when it ran originally.
Yeah.
And two, they were looking for a hit.
Well,
I can imagine
there was
revamping of shows is the way to go.
Yeah.
There was
recognizable properties, the same old thing.
There was an infamous diversity meeting in which the network sat down and had a discussion about how they could best reach voters who would have voted for Trump. And this is the stereotype of the white working class voter. But it was basically, it was held in late 2016, obviously after the election results came in and everybody was shocked. And one of the things that they had a big discussion about how they didn't have shows that necessarily catered to the white working class audience in the same way.
Isn't
that
literally
used to be
90% of all shows in the world?
Well, I mean...
They were interpreting it differently.
I think they interpreted...
What they heard
class.
Was people want overt racism. Like,
yeah. Well, this is the thing, because so, as somebody correctly pointed out, ABC had a really good, really well-made... like working class white sitcom in the middle, which ended its run this year as well, but it performed reasonably well in the ratings and had been well received for most of its run. But they wanted something a bit more crass, a bit more out there, and a bit more overtly Trumpian in its politics.
Well,
they
certainly
so,
got it.
Roseanne Barr, who has been a vocal Trump supporter from day one on Twitter.
She wasn't the vocal from day... Well, she and Michael Moore... signed a thing against Trump.
Did they?
Like a moral treatment this other day. What happened was they kind of appeared that Trump shouldn't become president. And as soon as he became president, she just did a turn on supporting for day one.
Interesting, because I know that Michael Moore is working on a documentary
yes,
about
that. That's
their
where, that's the story came from, that they actually worked together.
Interesting, because she's been quite vocal about conspiracy theories and stuff like that. And I mean, this
she's a crackpot. Like.
She's a complete crackpot. I mean,
there's no way to phrase it. Like,
I mean, you kind of feel sorry for the people who are caught up in this. Obviously the people who lost their jobs or whatever because like they did lighting on the sets and stuff, but at the same time people who knew what she was.
Let me ask you a question though in that regard. Like if you're John Goodman, and I'll use John Goodman because he would be the only Laurie Metcalf's in as well.
Laurie Metcalf's in as well.
I never really watched it when I was younger.
So
and
Sarah Gilbert's
zero
a show
desire to watch it now, but is there a thing where you could say, what the hell are you coming back to a show where this is clearly
Johnny Gilsenick, I don't know how you pronounce his name, from The Big Bang Theory, for example, also came back.
I think, though, back in the day, like, the show, and I haven't seen it now, but everything I've read about it seems to indicate that in its original run, it was something that was considered quite progressive.
Yeah, blue-collar,
blue-collar
kind of family, which that wasn't really shown on TV.
And it was seen as being maybe more inclusive or representative.
I think it was at the time.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe when they decided to bring it back, like anyone who was coming back to it was coming back to it with that mindset. Like maybe you could get into the psyche of, say, a Trump voter, but also maybe try and explore what led them to warped ways of thinking. Like that would have been more interesting rather than endorsing said warped way of thinking.
Well, this is the big tension with when it came back was the discussion about whether the film like endorses and critiques. So for example, Barr. The character is Roseanne Conner. The actress is Roseanne Barr. Barr is an avowed Trump supporter, and so Conner became an avowed Trump supporter. And when they brought it back, they had Laurie Metcalf's character, who is her sister, arrive and be a sort of a vocal Clinton supporter, and they had a big argument and stuff like that. The entire first episode was an argument between these two. But the debate was about bringing her back, basically created... an acceptable face of Trumpism.
This is my
problem. And this normalized it because, and again, this is the thing where it presented, and Grace is right when she says the show was originally progressive. It was very anti-racism. It was extremely anti-homophobia. It was doing these things at a time when most network television
wasn't
touching.
Even there wasn't a lot of representation of working class
people,
and there still isn't a lot of America.
Like. Yeah, and I mean there are great examples of that, of the family actually being poor and actually being like not being sitcom poor, being poor.
Yeah,
poor.
In the big house poor, which a lot of TV shows can
tend to be. But the thing with the revamp is that it lost a lot of the edge because it was unwilling to tackle the issues head on. So, for example, there's a scene in the very first episode where John Goodman's character and Roseanne Barr's character are trading their pills with one another because they don't have Medicare. Now, Roseanne Connor is a Trump voter, and nobody makes a connection there about why that is. Similarly, she has a grandchild who does not identify as gender conforming, who's non-gender conforming.
Right.
It never deals with the fact that she voted for somebody who banned transgender service in the military and who refused to allow the CDC to use transgender classifications.
Yeah.
Similarly, she has another grandchild who is part African American. Never explores why she's voted.
That's because she's in charge of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And you have this tension between, I think Sarah Gilbert is the showrunner who would consider herself liberal and progressive. And when it came back, she was like, well, we're going to use this to come back and have this discussion. But the issue is that you could never have that discussion because Barr would never.
It.
Yeah.
But the stories were beautiful. Particularly the last couple of seasons, I remember reading of the original incarnation of it, that as the show kind of went off the rails in its final season and stuff, that Barr was out of control and being an absolute nightmare to work with. So this coming back was... that's exactly what was going to happen.
But this is the thing, because when...
That plus Trump equals...
Yeah. When you praise ABC for acting so quickly, and they did act very quickly in this case, they knew this was coming. Like this wasn't the first time they had to answer questions about her feed. This isn't the first time she tweeted out.
It's the first time she's being racist. Yeah. It's not the first time she's done anything. She's
like
a horror show.
You have, for example, ABC executives joking about her Twitter feed in shareholder meetings and stuff like that. So it's not as if nobody knew this.
Publicity.
Yeah, nobody knew this was coming. It's like everybody knew this was coming in some way, shape, or form. They just didn't think it would be as severe as it ended up being. It's interesting though that there was a line drawn under it, which I'm glad to see, because those comments were racist. And I mean, people are describing those as racially charged. They're not racially charged.
Yeah.
They're racist. They weren't controversial, because controversial implies it's like, ooh,
was he wrong? Was she right? Was she wrong?
Yeah.
Just saying
like,
unpopular truth.
No. She compared an African American woman to a monkey.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, this is actual racism. This is like punch cartoons from the 19th century level of racism. And it's good that ABC basically came down hard and said, we're cancelling the show flat out.
You have the absolute farce of this sort of thing getting punished, like there being consequences for it in a country where like their leader is an absolute lunatic, like who just tweets out rubbish constantly, and similarly questionable and awful rubbish.
I mean, as somebody pointed out, all those people, those MAGA heads and Trump supporters are getting really outraged about this suppression of free speech, which is not a suppression of free speech. It's somebody being fired because, you know, she said something awful. It's like if somebody insults you in a shop, if a staff member calls you a fucker to your face in a shop, that's, you discipline them, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, all the people complaining about this as a free speech restriction. It's like, how do you feel about athletes kneeling during the national anthem? Just so we're clear on this.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make that connection, though.
No, it's very, very strange. And it's kind of interesting because it kind of branches out into, I was looking at the report, and again, we'll probably tweet this out and include this, but this is the statistics of like actors who've been accused of sexual assault by like the Me Too movement and stuff like that. And whether survey respondents are more or less likely to watch films and TV shows that they're in, and finding out that for most audiences, it actually makes very little difference how involved these people have been. Kevin Spacey is the outlier.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Spacey is the one exception to that, but by and large, audiences don't tend to care.
It's an interesting one, and even before the Me Too movement, I had this kind of conversation, and even taking Woody Allen aside, which is a whole
Polanski.
And Polanski, mm-hmm. But even somebody like James Woods, who I would have been a huge fan of when I was growing up, and watched quite a few of his films. The idea of sitting down and watching something like Salvador, which I was a fan of, which is very left-leaning Oliver Stone film.
Yeah.
And now...
And somewhere he plays the
character. Yeah. And the idea of watching that now with James Woods going full Roseanne left, right and centre is kind of...
Well, mostly
really
just right.
It doesn't appeal to me. And it's not a thing whereby I'm sitting down rationally to choose, I'm not watching this or I'm watching this. It's more of an emotional kind of reaction to something.
Yeah.
I just don't want to watch it. It just makes me feel a little nauseous. It's actually the idea of watching it, you know?
I think you made a very interesting point when we talked about this, I think maybe in relation to Polanski and Allen, which is that there is enough good and even great art in the world that's been produced by people who are not awful.
Pedophiles.
Yeah, who are not pedophiles.
Well, I thought that we mentioned before about the interview with Greg Erwig and the Labour, on the Labour set, of how nice and inclusive and friendly, and the idea that blows apart the idea that had to be an asshole on the set to make great art. On it. That's absolute nonsense.
Yeah, that is absolute nonsense.
It's shit.
That's
just
what I'm trying,
idiots.
Licensed.
It's the same kind of patriarchal notion that infuses so much of filmmaking culture, like right down to, say, method acting, which is basically a license to act like a prick half the time, you know,
even
the service of
a
supposedly
criticism.
Great performance. Yeah. And then other things like auteur theory, where like you attach all of the credit for the entirety of a film to one person, usually a man, which completely undermines and, you know, actively excludes, really, the contributions of the hundreds of people involved in putting that on the film together on a technical level and a creative level and everything else. There's just this notion that, you know, it's like a culture, a cult of personality, even, that, you know, the more actively terrible and domineering and everything else you are, that it somehow is a credit to you.
Yeah.
The film industry is far from the only industry that's like that, but it is...
I think it's particularly pronounced because of the idea that the film industry is not. And this is the thing.
And
the
there's so much money involved. Yeah. You know how people equate money with power, etc., etc.
But even like the infamous interview with, obviously, Jeffrey Tambor around Arrested Development that ran on the New York Times. But the thing is, like, you have Bateman's defense. And this is the observation that, you know, the world would be a much better place, obviously, if everybody knows not to be Tambor in this scenario. But you should also not be Bateman. That's the issue. You should teach people not to be Bateman.
But the problem with that is, and if you've heard the audio of it, which is it sounds a lot worse than reading
the text.
Interview, because this is where the real problems lie, I think. And as Grace pointed out, it's across a lot of industries. Is these guys don't even think; they just blather on and make their own opinion and force that opinion down. And Bateman is far from the worst. I think his apology, I think, was probably genuinely.
Yeah,
but they just don't, even at the base level of not being an asshole, they just don't realise and just don't care what they say. Because, like, Jeffrey Tambor's my mate, ergo, I'll just talk over everything and defend them no matter what. Well,
Bateman's argument was also that you treat making a film as something different from a regular job. As in, like, because, and I think Grace is right when you say this, is because it's art in the
exactly.
Comments. As opposed to a 9-to-5 job where it's like you have boundaries and stuff. And this is maybe, like, Jay, not to get back on point, but this is why you need more Ron Howards and Nancy Myers in the world.
But you just need people that are not assholes, full stop.
You do.
Universally well-regarded.
Ron Howard is not the worst person in the world. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
Saw that wonderful tweet about Solo where it was like it underperformed slightly, but I'm glad the people who liked it, and maybe you guys go...
And I had fun.
Yeah, I had fun. Go talk to people who saw it. See what they thought of it. And you're like, oh, Ron, your lovable, goofy uncle. But yeah, that's the thing. I think as Grace pointed out, like, the method acting, even, for example.
Yeah.
Like, Daniel Day-Lewis never method acted as a genuinely nice person. Nobody ever went, oh, I remember when he was method acting as that baker, and he made, like, croissants for everybody on set.
Yeah, I know. This is it, like, and that's what happens. It's an industry that's kind of let people get away with it for so long.
And
hopefully no more.
Well, again, we'll see how it goes. I mean, we are, as I think the founder was interviewed on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. She was saying, this is just getting started. And I suspect it absolutely is. I suspect this
you
is
certainly
just...
like to think so. And I think that's why having actual real-life consequences is so important, because everybody can talk till the end of time about how awful somebody's been or how many terrible things they've been accused of. And unless they actually see consequences in their day-to-day life, it's not going to have any impact on their behaviour.
I agree. And I think it lives and dies in that as well, because you hear all these articles, or read all the articles about, oh, such and such as Louis C.K. has planned his comeback, such and such has planned
their comeback. Charlie Rose.
Yeah, come back after like a few
but
months.
But they probably will, though. That's the worrying part. Like, sit out for 6 months and make a show.
I was genuinely surprised when Weinstein was arrested and charged with rape.
Me too. I think there's probably, beyond the pale regardless.
He's beyond the pale.
There's so many accusations that it's, and I think Spacey will probably end up saying.
But that was heartening. But yeah, I suspect that you'll reach the point where you will see people getting cycled in after a couple of years.
I want to see somebody do jail all the time. That's really where it has to be. It has to work.
Well, you have to. It has to be.
I couldn't think of a finer person.
Roman Polanski in that regard, what?
Yeah. No, he'll die in Switzerland. He won't be going to jail.
Oh,
well,
he gets to walk.
At the very least, though, I am sort of vaguely heartened with the amount of people who've come out and said that they were wrong to sign the letter. They shouldn't have signed the letter in the first place, but it's reassuring that people like Natalie Portman and Tarantino.
Oh, yeah, you read, like, the list of signatories and you're just thinking, what?
Yeah, how did... Meryl Streep, you're supposed to be a good person.
I know. Like, you have actually no excuse. Like, I remember when I was growing up, and, like, even when I was still quite young, and my mom would talk about films a lot because she's really into them, and Polanski was always one that whenever he came up, she'd just sort of wrinkle her nose and be like, he's disgusting. And I'm like, everybody bloody knew this. It's not like, you know, this was some hidden,
yeah, but Polanski,
hidden crime but that just emerged.
He was an asshole on sets as well. Yeah. And he was, like, in particularly in the author period, which came massive prevalence in the 70s.
Well, this is off the back of Hitchcock. Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah, with Hitchcock,
yeah,
there's your...
Yeah, there's your example. He'd joke about how he'd choke actresses and stuff.
No doubt. Yeah. No doubt.
The joys.
Anyway, so on that note, let's move to a more cheery subject, the top 10.
No, let's go back. Let's go back.
At number 10...
Do we have our usual ratio of 7 kids' movies to 3?
We shall see.
We actually don't. Not to get too spoilery.
Shock.
At number 10, on its way out, it's Breaking In. Which is Gabrielle Union and Bad Billy Burke in a home invasion thriller.
So his name is not Bad Billy Burke, right?
No,
his name, you keep saying that.
It's Billy Burke.
You keep saying that, that I'm starting to be convinced. This is terrible. What are you doing to me? I'm going to go into the cocktail party. It's like, have you ever seen that film with Bad Billy Burke? It's like, who? You've made such a faux pas.
What's his name?
Come on, it's just alliterative. Like,
it's good, but it's just... You know, when you use it more than once, it'll stick in my brain.
Like, that's sort of like the subtle...
There's a guy at work in my job I called Patrick and his name is Robert. This is what happens when people put names into my head. It's not good.
All right then. At number 9, and I'm actually quite glad to see it get in. I suspect this will be its only week. The Breadwinner, with a total of €15,000.
Abysmal distribution plan. As we pointed out 6 months ago, has come to fruition just exactly like we pointed out.
And as we pointed out, last week on the podcast,
we pointed this out last year.
Yeah, and
when it was shown at whatever it was shown in festivals last year, was it called?
I think it did the rounds there, and obviously it showed.
It was like a year ago.
It does feel like something that's kind of been on the back burner for a while.
It feels like somebody's holding the back. It's terrible.
And that's even appreciating that, like, you know, your regular Joe Soap public isn't going to have been as aware of it as we would have been from hearing people write about it and so on.
The Carmo gave her 5-star review.
Yeah, and a beautiful piece.
And then the really good review, really heartfelt and strong review. And it's like, if that had been in Oscar season or...
Yeah, that would have hit more, and it would have certainly gotten more adults.
Its total in the UK and Ireland was £79,000 for the 94th highest opening weekend of 2018. 94th highest, and we are not even like 100 weekends into the year. Well, obviously never going to be 100 weekends of the year, but we're not even like, 20 weekends?
Cartoons don't get a new distributor.
It's the 143rd highest opening weekend per location. Made only £50 more per location than Damo and Ivor.
That's more than
£50 better than Damo and Ivor. But
this seems like such an odd time of year to release it to. Yeah. Something like that you would picture as being a really obvious, like, slew of festivals from September to November and then drop it in, like, January or February.
When the Oscars.
Oscar season.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. It's exactly where it
And really, like, amp up the art house credentials.
Yeah.
And amp up the Irish thing. Because, like, the thing with... Like, Irish audiences generally have to wait for Oscar Prestige Fair. We have to wait until January or February or whatever, right?
When
they've already been nominated, when they've already had the buzz, when it's over. Like, I mean, I think Lady Bird opened the week before the Oscars were announced, which is absolutely absurd. I mean, if you have something like The Breadwinner with an Irish connection...
You're sitting on it.
So get it out there.
Yeah.
Yes, on the upside, though, it did earn $7,000 more than Song of the Sea.
I like Song of the Sea. You say that's like Song of the Sea is bad.
No, Song of the Sea's box office was bad.
Yeah, well, we probably had the same conversations. Like, if we did the podcast with Song of the Sea, it would probably be exactly the same conversation as that.
Here we are again.
At number 8, On Chisel Beach, which is the adaptation by Ian McEwan of his own novella, rather than a novel. Short read. We talked about this last week.
It's a good book. I haven't seen the film. I probably won't.
It's a perfectly grand film with two great central performances. It's a little messy, it's a little clumsy. It has two endings when it doesn't really need any of them. It's got a weird sort of Freudian sort of subtext where, like, it's all about explaining a young woman's sexuality in a way that's vaguely creepy. Just vaguely creepy, but it does look really nice. It has that sort of like really classy BBC sort of production, like Parade's End sort of Rebecca Hall, Benedict Cumberbatch sort of feel
to
it.
It has the look of something that would have been a 2-3 part BBC drama on a Sunday, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So I mean,
as opposed to a film.
Yeah. That's it. I was quite surprised that it's gone a theatrical release. I suspect Saoirse Ronan is the primary reason for her. She is also appearing with Samuel West in The Seagull, Chekhov's The Seagull, I believe, as well, coming out.
Yeah.
Film?
I've read about that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll believe it.
I'll take your word for it. At number 7, it's Life of the Party, starring Melissa McCarthy, with her husband writing with her and directing.
Who's her husband?
Ben Falcone.
Oh, okay. Well, I think we're smart. Then what about it?
Yeah.
It's the guy from Bridesmaids, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it is.
The guy that she gets chatting to on the plane.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I've
been learning so much this week.
It's just mind blowing.
It is.
But yeah, so 20 grand on a 200 grand total today.
Did you see this yet?
I have not seen this yet.
I like Miss McCarthy. I generally watch her films, so I'll get to this at some point, probably at home, I suspect. Mm-hmm. But I do like her films. Are we entertaining?
I love her films. Like, I think Bridesmaid and Spy, and like when she's working with Feig, they're two of the best studio comedies of the past 10 years.
Also, Gilmore Girls.
Gilmore Girls is a TV show.
I know.
Okay.
I'm aware of that there, and I've seen it.
Oh, okay.
I'm just saying,
with Netflix and the way that Netflix rolls episodes into one another, Jay might just have thought he was watching a really long film.
Like Twin Peaks.
The 18-hour film that is Twin Peaks.
Let's not go down that road.
At number 6, and again, I'm consistently impressed with how this is holding on here, I Feel Pretty, which is the Amy Sherman.
I was certain you were going to say The Greatest Showman.
Me too. I was going to say, what?
It's like, that's
yeah,
what
yeah.
Watch out, because here it is.
Schumer's a draw, though, isn't she?
Yeah, I would imagine Amy Schumer having a lot of, name recognition
but
for
yeah.
people is probably what's compelling.
How much money?
€750,000.
I know comedies generally do well here.
Yeah, we do. That's why they sort of drag over Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg every time they got like
they're usually for stinkers though, aren't they?
They are, yeah. You can tell how bad a film is by
how many
stars they put.
What's his name, the director of The World's End? Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright's
here! Oh, it must be a clunker.
Let's not get drawn.
Not get drawn into the sheer like wrongness of the person who tweeted today that.
Oh, yes, poor Bill, who I'm a huge fan of as a film critic. He's a brilliant film critic. And he's like, The World's End is one of the best films ever made. It's like,
you're trying to annoy everyone.
And Darren sits calmly on the fence. It's not the best film ever made. It's not the best film of its year. It's also not anywhere near the worst film of its year.
I thought it was absolutely fun. Right.
I thought it was pretty crap, to be fair.
That's so great.
Yeah.
And number 5, hanging on in there, Avengers Infinity War. You'll get there eventually. You just keep guessing, you'll be right.
Do you reckon Infinity War might get even more of a boost in the coming weeks when the kids are out of school?
Well, I suspect it'll be hanging on for quite a while. I don't know if it'll hang on as long as Black Panther did. Interesting.
This big kid still has to see it.
What?
This big kid still has to see it.
I need to see it again. I've been meaning to go again for literally a month and still haven't gone.
I saw Black Panther like 3 months after. It's like one of the last screens. Like,
this happens to me a lot though. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll get to that. And then like 3 months have gone by and I'm like, what do you mean it's not in cinema anymore?
How dare you?
Somehow I suspect Avengers Infinity War won't be disappearing.
Actually,
quite as soon as
I will get to that at some point.
I've seen it 3 times. It's good. It's solid. It's, I'm more impressed by the sheer technical like mechanics of how it was put together. Mm-hmm. Like the clockwork watch. The sort of the stuff that like, and again, not to drag Nolan into this, but the stuff that they accuse Nolan of doing, where everything's so meticulously and carefully designed so that it all ticks perfectly. Infinity War is just really well constructed in that respect. It's 70 named characters.
How many?
70.
Well, this is what they spent 10 years.
I know. 70 seems like a lot.
Jay's like,
I'm trying to count in my head. It's like I've got like 12, and I'm forgetting.
Yeah. I think if you cut half of them and you wouldn't lose much.
That's football Bethany.
There are some people who were
Vision
is a terrible character.
Bethany's
a terrible
character. It's not Hulk.
You could argue that there are multiple characters in the Avengers universe who were literally just there for comic book
Colton Grace,
recognition
give me
potential.
One.
Well, I'm not going to say Hawkeye because I kind of liked Hawkeye just from the perspective of him being like a normal person in this world.
He's not the worst for me.
Hawkeye is the worst.
I'd get rid of Ant-Man first because he just went for me. Yeah, sorry.
I feel like the universe would be rudderless without him, though.
He's good as comic relief, like in...
I'm looking forward to that matter
what. I don't think his jokes are appalling.
And unless they recast Doctor Strange, I'd get rid of him too.
Yeah, I'd have to get rid of him as well.
I find that really frustrating because I feel like Doctor Strange is a character who could and should be chewing loads of scenery and being a real like sort of standout.
Could have been Jackie and Phoenix, which I would have loved.
But no, it had to be Cumberbatchious.
I'm not a fan.
No?
I'm shaking my head.
Anyway, I am a fan of Infinity War. I liked it a lot. But so much goes on in it, and it never stops for breath. That's why I felt like I need to see it again so I can actually pick out the individual bits that I liked. Because mostly I was sitting there going, oh.
Within the next 6 or 7 podcasts, I will have seen it.
Okay.
Wait for favorite audience. Yeah, it is.
All right, do you want to take a guess at what's number 4? It's not Greatest Showman.
Ah, crap. Duck Goose.
Close!
I can't believe you even remember that film exists.
It was
one of my favorites of the year.
It was in there for like 7 weeks.
Duck Goose.
Oh, I think it's in Sheriff Gnomes.
It is, yes. That was a real gnome run there. So far.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. It's earned over $500,000 to date.
Oh, really?
So you're probably going to see a sequel to this.
I won't. I can assure you, I won't see this.
Do you want to take a guess at what is number 3?
Whatever good animation that was released this week, what was it?
Very good, Show Dogs.
Yeah. Oh.
Yes, the controversial Show Dogs starring.
Oh, yes, that's the one story that
you're talking about.
Yes.
Oh, good lord. Yeah.
At number 2.
Great Show?
Nope.
Ah,
nice try. Think about it.
Deadpool.
Boom, got it. Yep, Deadpool 2.
I am absolutely fascinated by the fact that every single person on my letterbox who has logged this has given a 3.5 stars. Yeah. Every single one. I'm like, is it a 3.5 star movie?
It might be. I think 3.5 stars is absolutely
I'm actually fascinated by letterbox in that regard. If I give something 3 stars and I want to see, particularly 3 stars, 3 stars is kind of solid, decent, like, and then I see 3 stars, I want to click on the review, it's like, this is amazing. It's like, that is not a 3-star movie. What are you thinking? And then it's like 2 stars. Like, that's wrong. The 1-star crank ones, which are usually me, in fairness.
the ranking, 1-star needs more Hawkeye.
Half-star. Good God.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with star ratings. I'm not a big fan of star ratings.
Yeah, I really like them.
The thing with Letterboxd is that I actually have to give stuff star ratings. So I find myself.
I think a weighting out of 10 is better, because 5 is just very minimal. Because if you say it's 4, then it makes it sound like it's excellent.
That's
why
3.5 is good.
So you mean like Deadpool 2 is what you're getting at?
Yes, but I haven't seen Deadpool
2. But 3.5 is a 7, so it works out.
Yeah.
Essentially the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although, again, ratings don't work like that. Like, nobody, 5 is considered a failure when it should be perfectly average. People giving a movie 5 out of 10 generally seems stable.
Oh, 5? Like,
yeah. 5 out of 5?
That's not the other, like, really?
I've introduced
how
a new.
How high are your standards?
Just, you know, not to bring another kind of bugbear of mine into the play again, but there's, on Letterboxd as well, just a matter of interest, there's far too many 5-star films in my life.
People
like, the 6th film this year, 5 stars, like, how is that possible?
People rate how they rate.
Yeah.
To
be fair, so long as somebody is. I like reading, like, responses to films that are clearly very subjective, and people are not writing them to sound cool or different or superficial or elitist, which is so much of film criticism, where they're just like, well, this is obviously, like, rubbish. But if you read something and you're like, yeah, I know lots of other people hate this, but I saw myself in this character and I like that, so.
Yeah, well, I thought somebody gave 4 stars to Mamma Mia, so there you go.
Really?
Hey, yeah. If Mamma Mia makes you happy.
Yeah, that's it.
Isn't that what movies are supposed to
be? Who are we to judge, Jay?
I don't know. I don't want to suffer grace. I don't make happy with anything.
Existence is just a howling void. But yeah.
I want to be able to just stare.
No, I agree with you in principle, even knowing that the fact that I don't always follow that same principle.
Yeah. People give ratings, how they give ratings. I
can't sit there and silently bitch about it as I go through. I judge them quietly.
I can think of 2 films last year I would have given 5 stars to on first watch. And that's
is one of them a Nolan film?
What? Yes, one of them is. Yeah.
Right. Let's
surprising.
Move on. Let's move
absolutely
on.
Nobody here. And you can probably guess what the other one was as well.
2017 seems like a long time ago.
Okay, cool. On that note, do you want to take a guess and then see what's at number 1?
Is it Solo?
It is Solo.
Oh, yeah.
Yay!
Yeah. Interesting situation with Solo where it's
it's bombed because it's made $160 million or whatever.
Which is a crazy situation to be in, because obviously it has that thing that Superman Returns also had, where Superman Returns had to roll in the budget of every failed attempt to make a Superman movie between Superman 4 and Superman Returns. And so its box office returns are measured against that. That's why, for example,
such an
That's why, for example, like Batman Begins, which was made a similar return box office wise, was considered a massive success because its budget didn't include any of that.
Exactly
where Superman Returns got burdened with all of this. Now, it obviously has its own problems, but it's interesting because, like, by any measure, Solo: A Star Wars Story is a competently performing, reasonable, you know, blockbuster, but because its budget is $250 million.
It's a lot of money. Plus, they need to reshoot late to 80% of the film.
That's it, between 70 and 90%. Like, it costs more to make than The Force Awakens. And I was...
But that's their own fault, though. Like, they stuffed the whole thing up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, how much of this is due to the...
Can I ask a question, though?
Yeah.
Because you're the big Star Wars fans here in comparison to me.
I'm going
to
feel that Grace feel this one.
Do we think a Lord of Miller Star Wars film would have done better?
Not necessarily. Because I think... Like, maybe if it was something that was a bit more distinctive and unique in its tone, it probably would have gotten a lot more word of mouth about it, which
possibly,
I think is good. But I also think Star Wars, to a sense, is going to suffer from the law of diminishing returns going forward.
Especially because, just two within 4 months.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like, I don't think it helped that Solo was put out now instead of at the end of the year when there's been a longer wait, and especially because the past 3 years they've released Star Wars movies in December, so you're building up kind of a sense of occasion around
it. Like, and they also would give them more chance to fix it as well.
I think cynically they probably pushed it out a bit sooner because there was somewhat tepid reaction in certain quarters to The Last Jedi, so they were like, well, this is more like old style, it will satisfy them.
There's also, I think, that they didn't want to interfere with Mary Poppins as their Christmas blockbuster this year.
You think that there's more than enough audience diversity there?
Also, you could almost counter-program it to some degree.
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to counter-program with yourself,
Like, both films could make a fortune. Like, you know, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I do think, like, part of me kind of wishes we were able to see Miller and Lord.
Me too.
Solo movie. But just so you get something distinctive, because, like, say, even with Rogue One, which I thought was quite sloppy in many ways, but it did feel a bit... different. Like,
I agree.
Particularly in its first two thirds, which were largely Edwards films.
I thought, it did. It felt like a standalone film.
Mm-hmm. And the way it ended, I felt, was very good. Like, it made it stand out a wee bit.
Deep impact.
So.
Okay.
Had the deep impact ending.
Okay.
Literally. The whole deep impact.
I am a fan of deep impact.
I think it's great. I love the Mini Leaders. It's terrific.
Armageddon for the win.
No!
I really like Armageddon. Deep impact is the thinking man's Armageddon.
That's also true.
For those intellectuals.
Does the thinking man need an Armageddon?
As he does.
Yes.
Mini Leader also made Peacemaker, which is also great.
I like the Peacemaker.
Peacemaker is terrific.
Massively underrated.
With George Clooney.
Yes, and Nicole Kidman. It's great. It's really, she's a perfect actor.
I did not know
that. She critiqued on a ton of the yours you made, and she was great, actually.
Well, I miss those 90s sort of mid-tier
mid-budget
thrillers.
Loads of them.
But mid-budget thrillers that were event movies. Like, that's the thing. It's like, because if you release that today, it will be like an indie starring Oscar Isaac made on one half the budget.
Yeah.
Which would consist of lots of rooms, lots of people sitting in rooms.
The political backdrop as well would just be a bit of a mess. I think that's the other thing that I really miss about those 90s movies is not just the filmmaking aspects and the aesthetics of them, but also the sense that, like, there was nothing really terrible going on politically anywhere. I mean, there were terrible things, but nothing overtly terrible, like in-your-face terrible, like Trump, Brexit, etc. going on now. So they just had these generic bad guys who, like, I don't know, wanted to blow up a bomb because of reasons, and that's good enough.
9/11 changed everything for filmmaking. Not to degrade anything else. I mean, but if you can write about it in that context, it changed how films were made and how...
Because it gave you a completely new archetype for the bad guys.
Remember Collateral Damage? Remember that was famously about to be released, but then had to be postponed? And then was supposed to be released again? It was, that sort of mess.
Some serious collateral damage there.
Yeah, but the issue is that even that stuff can't be... Because 9/11 casts such a shadow that even escapism cannot escape it. So, like, the destruction of cities... So if you look at the destruction of cities in, say, 90s blockbusters like Independence Day or Godzilla, right? It's all very broad. It's cartoonish. Like, you can get on board, you can watch it. The issue is that when you look at urban destruction, it has to be filtered through the prism of 9/11. So every time you're watching...
it's very ground level. Yeah. It's very, like, you're looking
first responder.
That's metal.
The broken buildings, the crust, the cars under dust, the people scrambling.
Won't the filmmaker go back to the 90s aesthetic? Won't somebody try?
Well, the question is, can you do that and will the audience get on board with it? Because the issue is that, like, Rampage, to pick an example from this year, it's a movie in which The Rock's best friend is a gigantic, like, several thousand pound gorilla, but it still has 9/11 urban devastation.
Could Skyscraper be that?
Interesting.
Because it does look, and I actually really want to see Skyscraper, because you're talking to a big flat Terminal Vernal fan, so this looks right up my street. Like, but the good nonsense kind of, the 200 floor building, and now, blah, 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 whatever happens. It doesn't matter what happens, because it's a 200 floor building, The Rock. It doesn't matter.
Is there an aspect of that in Kong Skull Island, which doesn't really have a massive political
background?
I know it's set during Vietnam, but you don't have the same sense of something like just permanently crawling out of the woodwork.
No, things are just
And you know, all of the destruction is played in a very sort of, this sounds terrible, light comedic way, like when people
die.
It's film.
Like, you have to learn how to do that, or you just get out to do that.
And
that's part of that film's appeal, because like I really loved Kong Skull Island, and I was kind of surprised because I was expecting not to like it very much. And I think there are aspects of it that do feel in some ways like a bit more vintage, maybe, in that regard.
Well, I mean, I think the island setting helps there, because you don't have skyscrapers, so you don't have to evoke 9/11, because that's what people think of. That's the first place your mind goes, is the video footage, the handheld footage, the sort of the shaky cam.
The interesting thing, though, and you guys are probably, not probably, you're too young, but I saw Independence Day when it came out in the cinema, and it's hard to describe to people that didn't the kind of awe-inspiring of see something blown up the White House. It was like, oh my, like it's some, the White House, and it was kind of clearly a model White House, which is fine also. They kind of, you know,
it holds up.
Absolutely. But like, to see something like that was an event in the way that, and in a film event, it's not a real White House. You're never quite sure in films post 9/11 because it feels like 9/11, so you can never dissociate.
What is the uncanny valley sort of thing? Soldiers? Zach? I don't know how you pronounce it. The Welcome to the Desert. No, but the Welcome to the Desert, the real. His argument that, like, because after 9/11, the way that we filmed these sequences became more convincing and real and more related to what we saw on, like, cable news. But also the use of CGI became more, at once, ubiquitous, but also harder to distinguish from the real image itself. So you had this idea of like 9/11 being described in terms of like a blockbuster. People who were interviewed on cable news talking about it as if it was akin to watching something.
Because everybody saw on TV, it is akin to that.
Yeah.
And I saw it on TV too, the day after day. So I watched an episode with a kind of horror show, almost popcorn-esque vibe. It didn't seem real, even though it was very real.
Yeah, so I didn't believe it when I saw it happening either. I had no idea what it was. But I remember my first reaction was when he told me it was happening was, that's nuts, that can't be. Like,
for an hour, I felt like the war was going to end, because when it happened, the buildings came down, and it was like, and then the buildings and planes crashed first, then it was like, there's a plane head towards Washington, and there's another plane here. It was like, this could happen anywhere in the world now. Like, this for like an hour, it's like, it felt like, and this is kind of, it wasn't pre-internet, but it was certainly
pre-Twitter, obviously.
Pre-social media. It was like, kind of, I think it was bonkers. And it has changed filmmaking, and it changed blockbusters, particularly. And for the worse, I would say.
On that note, let's move into talking about the upcoming releases and whether or not they're influenced by this. So, Jay, Book Club. How has Book Club been shaped by 9/11?
Donald Clark, not a Nancy Myers movie.
Donald Clark gave it a 1-star review, as did Peter Bradshaw.
This is interesting.
So it has potential, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh!
This is interesting, because I've heard mixed things about this, because people who love it seem to really genuinely love it. People who hate it seem to hate it with the passion of a thousand burning stars.
Yeah.
Which is like, Darren's
nobody's
like,
making you see it.
Yeah. I'm like, this is fantastic. There is no way I can have a sitting on the fence response to this movie, is there?
And yet
Darren comes back next week, he's like, scratch. Not the worst movie.
It's a perfectly serviceable movie.
Yeah. It's competent, it's well made.
It's Fonda and
Alicia Silverstone, Diane Keaton, Mary Steenburgen, Candice Bergen, Jane Fonda, Don Johnson.
Alicia Silverstone?
Yeah.
Jesus, when's the last time I've seen her in something?
Killing of a Sacred Deer.
She was in Killing of a Sacred Deer, she was a smaller part.
She's
Barry Cohen's mother.
Yeah, she was the mother.
Yeah.
And this is a directorial debut.
Bill Holderman, I believe,
Interesting.
So I'm kind of curious about this. This is obviously about a bunch of middle-aged women who start a book club reading 50 Shades of Grey.
I'm probably not going to see this. I'm not gonna lie to you here.
You were on board there with the Kenny's Bergman and the James.
It might have had me at least a silver stone, but that might wait till the home.
What you mean you didn't have a such Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, Mary Steen Bergen?
I do like all of those actresses, but this film just sounds a bit.
I know it's
a hell of a cast. It also has Andy Garcia, Richard Dreyfuss, Craig T. Nelson.
Jeez, they're really going after the great daughter.
Yeah.
Jesus.
For a debut director.
No silver dollars left, yeah. It's astonishing. Well, I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that like actors of that generation caliber aren't given that much to do, particularly actresses or particularly female actors. Like, I mean, again, that's a phenomenal cast. Like, those are among the best performers of their generation.
Great.
And just, like, and again, not to diminish it, but like, to see them doing this is interesting because on the one hand it looks like they all had great fun doing it and that's fantastic. They all get paid doing it, that's also fantastic. And it's like, but Diane Keaton, like, surely you could do something with Diane Keaton that's like, you can also do this, but you could do, you know,
See, that's my problem with this kind of film, is that exactly what you're getting at. Like, they're all fine actresses, and you think...
I don't want to be dismissive.
But I'm not saying there's no merit in this, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying there's dramatic roles that can be, like, actresses they can still use, they're not put out the pasture into old, funny movies.
Well, that's
not,
like,
you can't do anything else.
Nobody gets, like, a female Brewster in role in Nebraska, for example, or something like that. Or Christopher Plummer role in All the Money in the World.
Yeah.
That's sort of, like, the
stage. That's what I mean.
Like, you had, say, what was it called, Grandma, a few years ago, which was a very good vehicle for Lily Tomlin, but that's very much the exception to the rule.
Helen Mirren in Red is the only one I can kind of, and Red too.
Yeah.
The only ones
and she's, like, the lead character.
No, no, but even as an ensemble, it's not... Mm-hmm. You know,
I absolutely adore the fact that she bullied her way into the Fast and Furious and got really upset when she wasn't allowed to drive a car.
I will know.
And then they found
the
perfect niche for her.
It really is. Well, we won't spoil it for Jay because Jay's about to embark on an ambitious project.
Are you going to watch all of
them? Yes.
Oh my god. I'm so excited. I love these movies. We'll
get to relive them vicariously through your eyes.
We'll do a special Fast franchise podcast.
Yeah.
Yay.
The Fast and the Fury.
I defy you not to be drawn in by all the talk of family and loyalty. Family.
Family's got to work, isn't it?
But you have to say it though in the voice of Vin Diesel. It's about family.
You don't turn your back on family. Yeah.
Even when they turn their back on you.
They sound terrible. That's
Fast 6 is the best one.
5.
So you say it's a plow through 4 to get
the
good stuff. Yay!
As somebody pointed out.
You will unfortunately have to watch you could probably skip the second one.
I don't skip
but
anything.
You need
if I don't have to watch them all and in order.
You need to watch the third
and in order. I like that.
I can't even watch another sequence. And if I'm going to watch series 1, I have to watch them all.
Right.
It's OCD and I can't help it.
Okay, well, we'll just suffer through the third one because
I'll
something that happens
all
and it actually becomes important.
Is
thing.
The third one Tokyo Drift? Okay.
Stop it now, stop.
Yep.
Good lord.
Also out this week, and probably not on Jay's Fast and Furious watch list, is...
Le Monde Double.
Thank you very much, Grace. In which Chloe, a fragile young woman, falls in love with her psychoanalyst, Paul. A few months later, she moves in with him, but soon discovers that her lover is concealing a part of his identity.
It sounds like every French show I've ever seen.
It
like, he's making it through thousands of these
a
year.
Yeah. There are sex and secrets. Cool. Also out this week is My Friend Dahmer, which I screened in ADIF earlier.
It's got a lot of good reviews. I didn't see it in ADIF. I actually didn't know screened in ADIF.
It screened in competition with the surprise film, so I missed it. I chose to see Unsane instead. Which...
That wasn't a bad choice.
It was a great surprise film. It may not have been a particularly good film, but
no.
It was a great surprise film. And My Friend Dahmer, great reviews. I mean, Graham saw it for Scanlon, he reviewed it, he absolutely loved it.
He's not the only one. The review's pretty strong.
I remain, like, very curious with this, because I am somebody who is vaguely fascinated by the 90s fascination with serial killers. Which is interesting, because, I mean, we're talking about, like, things that changed with 9/11. Like, with 9/11, the serial killer kind of immediately went out of fashion.
Yeah.
But you think about, obviously, during the 90s, you had Silence of the Lambs, you had stuff like Kiss the
Girls,
Seven. Yeah.
Small beam.
The Cell and all this
sort
of stuff.
The Cradle.
Yeah, all this sort of stuff. And then like with 9/11 all of a sudden the terrorists are back into focus. The point where like and nobody's gonna see the Liam Neeson vehicle Walk Among the Tombstones, I suspect, right?
Well, I've seen it.
You've seen it?
I haven't.
Okay, but you're not gonna rush out and see it so I can spoil the
It's
the
actually
ending.
As late Liam Neeson goes, it's not bad.
It's not as good as The Commuter though.
I was gonna say, is it on a par with The Commuter though?
Better than
The
Commuter.
Which is
a benchmark.
I've got to make an educated guess and say it's better than The Commuter.
But my favourite thing about Walk Among the Tombstones is that it's a serial killer movie starring Liam Neeson, so it feels like a 90s throwback. And the closing shot is the camera panning out the windows to a shot of the Twin Towers still standing, as if to say, yes, this was a 90s throwback. Congratulations, Darren.
Remember me.
Yeah. Well, the end of Remember Me is quite different for other reasons. That isn't a slow pan. Twin Towers.
No spoilers here.
Yeah.
Not to get all oldie kind of back in the day stuff, but I used to, back in the old days when people had pen pals, I had a pen pal in Milwaukee. And the reason I bring it up is because Jeffrey Dahmer is from Milwaukee. And she...
I was waiting on you to say Jeffrey Dahmer was from
Penn. No, I'm not even based. I'm not even searching for those letters, like, oh my god. No, he's not. That was
there are some girl. Really weird cooking suggestions in here.
So it would have been probably 15 ish, maybe? I think, I can't remember. But she didn't know Jeffrey Dahmer, but she.
Well, presumably it was a massive, like,
huge thing.
It was a huge thing. Like, I mean, anyone who has
read... I didn't notice the news didn't get quite over here as quickly as it does now, but that kind of thing.
Like, I mean, like, anybody who's read the case or knows anything vaguely about the Dahmer case, it's salacious and horrifying, and so it is pretty intense, and it's easy to see why it captured the national attention the way it did. My friend Dahmer apparently covers it quite tactfully. It's set all before the killings.
It's a prequel.
Thank you, Jay, in this franchise terms. But it's obviously based on the graphic novel, which was written by Durf Backdurf. Durf Backdurf.
Show me that. That can't be a name.
Darren's mispronunciation strikes again.
Durf Backdurf. My God, that's a name.
Yeah, but he basically went to school with him. He was one of the kids who was friends with him while he was in school together. Noticed that he was quite odd and stuff. But it's basically a recollection on their teenage years together.
Okay, I should get to this. This sounds fascinating.
I really, really want to see this. It also features a performance from Vincent Kartheiser from Mad Men and Angel. And also, obviously...
Strike.
What?
Little scene, but much-loved movie made by Kirsten Dunst in 1998 called Strike.
Direct?
Oh.
No.
Oh,
she's just in it.
Strike, never heard of
it. It was made by Sarah, her surname escapes me. It's about a boarding school in New York in the 60s.
Good.
It's very fun. It's cool. Very fun.
Strike.
Yeah.
Cool. So
it has like three other names depending on which country you're in.
Okay.
I know the Strike.
It's like Edge of Tomorrow type stuff.
Yeah.
Anne Hesch is also in this as well. And the lead actor, Ross Lynch, is one of those former Disney stars trying to reinvent himself as an actor by kind of shedding off the... Literally shedding the skin, although not necessarily his own, in the role of Jeffrey Dahmer. So anyway, that's it for this week, but we'll be back next week. But obviously in the meantime, if you want to find Grace and Jay online, where can we find you guys?
You can find me on Twitter at PixieGrace.
On Twitter also at JayCloud.
You can follow me at Darren_Mooney. Take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye!
Later!